Good morning and welcome. You are tuned into 2ACR 107.3 and it is time for a half hour of books, writing and literary culture that we like to call Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel and I am here to share great new Australian writing with you. In fact, I have two fantastic new Australian authors coming in to speak about their new books today. Before we get to that, just a couple of messages, if you'll allow me. If you would like to support community radio, this is a fantastic time to do it. Just go to 2ser.com, click on support. You can make a tax-deductible donation, and your donation goes to helping 2ser do what it does, forming our community, supporting our arts, supporting music. And we really thank you for that. We thank everyone who is a part of the 2ser community. I'd also like to just let you know that Final Draft has a podcast, and that podcast is about to turn one. The Final Draft Great Conversations podcast presents amazing authors from across Australia, and over the last year, I've been able to give you so many new books, and I want to know which was your favourite, so vote with your ears, go back, listen to your favourite episode again, and when July rolls around, our first birthday, I will be letting people know the most popular just to celebrate our first birthday. Now, coming up on the show today, I have two fantastic new Australian books. First off is a bit of an appropriation. This is an Australia, New Zealand author who lives in Australia, R.W.R. MacDonald, has written The Nancys. It is a strange and wonderful homage to the Nancy Drew mysteries, taking us to South Otago and Tippi Chan, who is an 11-year-old crime-solving mystery wonder. I can't wait to have R.W.R. MacDonald on the show so we can tell you more about the Nancys. And later on in the show, I am going to be joined by Sarah Hopkins. Her latest novel is The Subjects, and this is a dark, psychological, intellectual thriller that just has so much to say. And I really want everyone to discover this, and because it made me think about our world, and I can't wait to hear what Sarah has to tell us about it. You are on 2SER 107.3. This is Final Draft, and the books are coming after this short break.
Sydney Film Festival returns from June 5 to 16 with over 250 of the best films, famous guests, raucous parties and red carpet premieres. See the greatest, strangest and most exciting Australian features and documentaries alongside the best of international festivals, including Sundance, Berlin and Cannes. Sydney Film Festival takes over 8 iconic cinemas across Sydney for just 12 days. Tickets are on sale now, so be quick. See sff.org.au for more. 2SER is a media partner of Sydney Film Festival.
Good morning, you are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. You are listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. I am joined on the line now from New Zealand by R.W.R. MacDonald. He's a Kiwi in Australia, in New Zealand, and we're going to be discussing his debut novel, The Nancys, which before it was even the spectacular pink masterpiece that you can hold in your hands, was highly commended at the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards. Welcome, Rob. Welcome to Final Draft.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to introduce The Nancys to people because the South Otago town of Riverstone is the sort of place that you leave. And that's what Tippi Chan's Uncle Pike did as soon as he was old enough. Tippi's 11 years old, and the only way she can escape is in the pages of her uncle's beloved Nancy Drew mysteries. Pike's back, though, with his officially long-term partner, Devon. They're looking after Tippi, but with only two pubs and a shortage of boutiques in Riverstone, there's not much to do. That is, until a body is discovered by the traffic light. And finally, the Nancys have a mystery to solve. I love this. I was immediately excited by the Nancys, Rob. I grew up reading Nancy Drew, the Hardy Boys, the Three Investigators, Encyclopedia Brown. I'm sounding like a really exciting kid, aren't I?
No, that's fantastic.
Now, Nancy Drew, though. Nancy Drew's almost 90 years old.
Yeah.
She's not unproblematic, and she's also something of a Madonna slash the Doctor child of reinvention, going through a slew of guises and iterations from the white bread wholesome to the dark and gritty. How did you want Tippi and Pike and Devon to intersect with this unfolding history?
So the idea for the story first came to me, and it was a snatch of dialogue, and I knew it was a child speaking, and she was talking about investigating a murder. And then that led me to her babysitting uncle and his boyfriend. And from there, I was trying to, well, I guess I was thinking, what would get a child so excited to, you know, do something as kind of dangerous and outrageous as investigating a murder? And then that's when the idea of Nancy Drew came. And the thing I like about Nancy, so in the book, both Tippi and her uncle really love the sort of 1930s Nancy. And as you mentioned, she's been through quite a few iterations. She was quite wild for a time. She was driving around. She had a gun. She was, you know, there was no, didn't seem to be any kind of privacy laws when it came to finding out all the details of her father's, who was a lawyer, his cases. And I really love the intergenerational aspect that Nancy Drew affords for these characters. So it turns out that actually Pike's mum had a couple of copies as well. So you've got this fantastic, I guess, character that's gone through their family history.
Now, straight away, you establish a bit of a tension between Tippi's precocious interests and what's deemed appropriate for sort of preteen eyes and ears. And then you decapitate a body and ramp it up to 11, and Tippi's kind of thrown further into the mystery. It struck me, though, that as we get older, we forget that as children, we were curious about this darkness and we were interested in these things. Was this important for you to address?
Yeah, it was. When Tippi first came to me, that was in 2006. In 2007, I became a dad to a daughter, and then I had another daughter, 2008. And my kids were born into a time where we had the those horrific ISIS beheading videos, you know, terrorism, particularly in countries outside of, you know, countries that were at war. That became the norm. These kids grew up with all of that. They didn't know a time before that. So I wanted to explore that. And also I look, my girls are, of course, I'm, you know, their dad, so I'm going to say they're fantastic, but they have a, they seem to have very dark, you know, any stories ends up with usually multiple homicides, or the parents die off in the first paragraph, or, you know, I guess even Disney, the parents get it quite early on. So yeah, I think we do forget that they are drawn to that and experience it.
I wonder how that works for us, though, because as you mentioned, like Nancy, she drove, she had a gun. I mean, when I read these when I was a kid, I didn't know any better. I just assumed that's what everyone did in the 30s. And now we have this phenomenon, you know, it's always commented on that Gen X and millennials kind of, you know, maybe refuse to grow up. Do we have a vested interest in keeping children in this sort of utopian idol of childhood, whether or not that's their reality?
Yes, I think so. And I think this is where Pike is so different for Tippi, is because he is not a parent, and he hasn't, but it's not so much that, he just hasn't had that much to do with children. And so he's treating her almost as an adult, and he's not buying into this, you know, cotton wool, or he thinks, and I think he's right, that she's a lot stronger than what her mum, perhaps, who has lost, I don't think it's a spoiler because we say it at the beginning, her father, Tippi's father, died 9 months ago, and her mum has, you know, she's probably more protective of Tippi now because of that loss. So, yeah, I think Pike just wants to, her uncle just wants to push her to see, you know, that she is capable. And also, I think to give Tippi some agency, which she, being overprotected, isn't able to really experience.
Now, a body turns up and Pike, Devon, Tippy, form the Nancys. It's their homage to Nancy Drew, and it's also their way of, well, I think for Pike and Devon, it also gives them something to do. For Tippy, it gives us something to keep her occupied. But mysteries have rules, even formulas, and they're always a product of their times. And technology has changed the game. With information and connection, they're always at hand. And I wondered as I read, did you need to go to a small town that only had one traffic light? Did you need to put Pike and Devon on a digital detox complete with a soap phone substitute? Dear listener, please read the book for that to make sense. Did you need those things to get the right elements in place for this kind of Nancy Drew investigation?
Yes. Is the, yeah, definitely. Look, they could still be in a small town, but, you know, just do it from the living room. And I didn't want that. I wanted to capture some of that or pay homage to, you know, Nancy was out and about all the time. You know, she was driving around or, you know, going to the tea shop or going to Moon Lake. So I really wanted them out of the house. And so I thought one of the ways is to restrict that amount. Now, they do have a tablet, so they do look things up, but I didn't want them out there with a smartphone.
It is a fascinating conundrum, how much technology intersects with a good mystery. And I love the way you balanced it. And also, of course, Tippy is younger. She was never going to drive. So we have almost kind of Stranger Things type scenarios where she has to get around town on a bike, but she's also using those old detective skills of she's counting how long it takes to get anywhere. And you can sort of see how she's exercising her detective brain that she has developed.
At the beginning, I'd say she's quite numb. There's a lot of internal thoughts. She keeps saying she's okay when people ask how she's doing because of her dad. And then as she gets more, I don't want to say more agency because that comes from within her, but I guess permission to run with it. And you know, that does have consequences as well. But I wanted her to be able to get out and about and to, you know, really, this was her, I guess, project and her to be the lead. And as they talk about in the book, it's something she's actually really good at, is solving puzzles and tracking down clues.
I am speaking with R.W.R. McDonald. Now, his debut novel is The Nancys. It is an absolutely glorious, I'm going to call it a romp, but it's also a fantastic mystery, taking us into the world of the Nancys. And it's a beautiful homage also to Nancy Drew. So if you grew up reading mysteries, this is definitely a novel to check out. Rob, thank you so much for taking the time and talking to me about The Nancys.
Thank you so much, Andrew. I'm so pleased you enjoyed it.
Now we are going to take a quick track before coming back with our second book for the day, Sarah Hopkins, The Subjects. You are on Final Draft on 2SER 107.3, and this is something new from Wagons. I think it's their first new music in about 5 years. From Wagons, this is Keep On Coming Back.
Can I share?
You're tuned into 2SER 107.3. You are listening to Final Draft, and my name is Andrew Popel. We just heard a track from Melbourne band Wagons that was Keep On Coming Back. Now, I'm joined in the studio by Sarah Hopkins. Sarah's a lawyer and an author. Her novels include This Picture of You and The Crimes of Billy Fish, which was shortlisted for the Commonwealth Writers' Prize. Now, today, Sarah's joining me to discuss her latest novel, The Subjects. Sarah, welcome. Thanks for coming into 2SER.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to be here.
So, as the subjects begin, we're being transported alongside Daniel to an unknown destination. And Daniel's a teenage drug dealer, exclusively kind of prescription and dark web type of product, but he's been diverted from jail at the last minute by a strange intervention. Dr. J runs a facility, and Daniel will come to call it a school. There, Daniel joins a group of unorthodox teenagers, alike but different to himself, to serve out their punishments in this remote outback setting. So we travel alongside Daniel, and here's where we get, this is right where I'm starting, both his younger and his older selves, meeting a cast of young offenders and misfits, and they each have their own story. And let's just start with the fact that you establish really early on that that Daniel is looking back on this time. And you complicate that because it's also being told as he lives it. Why the two Daniels? Why? And I was also intrigued because you've now given me two narrative arcs and two mysteries perhaps that are going to unfold. Why two Daniels?
So, I mean, it's to build the intrigue around the story, but it's in terms of the narrative, the older Daniel has a very specific purpose in telling the story. It would be a spoiler to tell you what that purpose is, because you don't discover what the actual purpose of him telling the story is until the very end of the book. There's a sense that he's trying to set the record straight in some way, and that just small pieces of information are revealed gradually throughout the book. So you start getting a sense of what that is. But as I said, it doesn't become clear until the very end.
It's so complicated now to know which Daniel's story to follow. So maybe we'll just also then look at the group, at the subjects of the novel's title. They can all be viewed as useful or talented people. We sort of vacillate between how we view them as we get to know them. And their inclusion in their school is for a specific purpose. Now, the subjects, it's very much an exploration, though, of that kind of institutional intervention. Both the criminal justice system, but I sort of thought also that kind of biomedical model of the way we and you can't see air quotes or scare quotes, but treat people on radio. I wondered, well, first, why Daniel out of this entirely interesting group? Alex and Rachel also jumped to mind as two people with amazing stories. How did you settle on Daniel?
Okay, well, just a couple of things just in that question of yours. Yes, it's not the focus. The starting point is the criminal justice system, but what comes into it is both the education and the health system.
Yeah.
Settling on Daniel, I mean, he was just my first voice. The 16-year-old boy, I decided fairly early on I wanted to write in the first person. This is the first book I've written in the first person. And that was the voice that became natural to me for some reason.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain that. I do have an adolescent son. That might have been part of it. Probably also, you know, because of my work in the criminal justice system, I came across so many, you know, young boys. The cohort of offenders that I have represented tend to be the younger ones in any event, boys, not girls. So I suppose I was more familiar with a young male offender. And I was also interested to really explore a young man who had a very strong and dangerous capacity for violence. So that wasn't Alex. So Daniel was my starting point. And then, you know, moving into characters like Rachel and Alex, they became equally important to me. But Daniel was my first person narrative.
So if we then think about this sort of institutionalized realm that you take them into and that we skirt across from the legal system to that sort of biomedical model of diagnosis and treatment. All of the subjects, we'll keep using that word, it's your title, all of the subjects also can become, and in the world at large, victims of a kind of a reductive labelling process that very much we see I'm going to call it a dance. I'm not going to say it's an escape from in the subjects, but there is a dance with it, this reductive labelling process. How did you want to engage with those ideas of labelling and treatment and incarceration or freedom?
Well, I suppose ultimately the idea is, how do you penetrate those labels with a story, with the real story? And that's what this book is doing, in a sense, is it's looking at this group of teenagers who are all extraordinary for one reason or another, who have been labelled and by and large have been labelled as you say, misfits and failures, you know, as people with sicknesses. So I was really interested in, well, how do you kind of cut through that and actually tell their story in all its detail, its terrible and beautiful detail, because that in my mind is what we so often miss, that these systems that we've set up, justice, health, education, we're missing the real stories of what's happening with these young people. And I think the only way to really support them is to find out those stories.
Ideas of knowing and not knowing and what that can mean for us. And you intersect with that in a couple of different ways. The first one I want to ask you about is, it's a quote from Daniel following, I think it's an interaction with Alex, where he talks about sometimes we need to be seen. And every process there, it has its positive and its negative outcomes. Daniel discovers ways of being open as he begins to make friends, but this kind of contrasts with his protective sense that to be hidden is akin to safety. There is a recurring motif, almost a mental block that he has around having hidden at a particular time. How do these various ways of hiding and being seen allow, I guess there's a tension that I want to explore, people to both fall between the cracks, but then also allow themselves to be safe in that anonymity?
That's such a good question. You know, my experience with young people is that they are so often a minefield of secrets. That's how they operate, and that's how they survive. So that kind of secrecy is a survival mechanism for young people. And as you say, it's how they stay safe. It's how they feel safe, because they don't want themselves exposed, and also because they carry guilt and shame around who they are and what they're thinking, what they want. So I think that in part Daniel's journey, and the journey of each of the characters actually, is around, well, what's the value in laying yourself open just a little and then more until you are really seen? And there's a liberation in that. And ultimately, I think certainly for Daniel and for Rachel, that ability to be seen is what saves them. So there's that tension.
Yeah.
That something that once was so important as a survival mechanism is what they need to shed. To grow as human beings.
So we're going to keep this in the context of the story. We're in the school, and this is very much a journey that each of the characters is going through. So when we're talking about sharing and being seen, this is the action of the book. And then we have this, I found a really interesting counterpoint to that, an idea of knowing and not knowing, and maybe a call to action, perhaps for adults, perhaps for everyone as they go through that kind of nascent consciousness emerging of their place in the world. What do we do once we know? And I don't think it's spoiling anything because it's so intricate the way you develop this, but the Human Misery Project and Alex's work, and I feel like that name alone should just fascinate people to discover more. And Rachel challenges him on it. She wants to know what is going to be done. And there is a tension between the characters as they discuss this. I feel like Daniel has this perspective that, and the Human Misery Project is about all of the misery in the world, and it's so confronting. Daniel says, well, until he knows everything he needs to know, he doesn't know how he can act on it. But then there is a sense that not knowing allows us to ignore it, and knowing somehow challenges it, but it's always going on. Whether we know it or not, there's always something terrible going on. How do we choose to draw ourselves into it? And I was just so fascinated with why you wanted to engage with that, and the way it counterpoints the emerging consciousnesses of the of Daniel, of Rachel, of Alex, and how they try to engage with each other.
Look, I think that Alex is making a superhuman effort to confront what's happening in the world. Mm. He's so vulnerable and sensitive to, as you say, human misery around the world, that his task that he set himself is to understand it and to know it. And he thinks that by doing that, he'll have some control over it, and he'll be able to continue to live in this world, because that's his question. Can I continue to live in this world as it is, with all its misery, with all the human suffering? But he's challenged in that by Rachel, who says, well, okay, you can know all this, and good on you. You know, you've got this far. You know, his project is an extraordinary one, and the amount of work he's done, the detail that he's brought together, is impressive. But her question is, what's the point in knowing until you act on it?
Mm. This is the subject, and it is an absolutely mind-bending, engaging novel from Sarah Hopkins, who is sitting opposite me here in the 2SER studio. Sarah, thanks so much for coming in and indulging me. I think this is... The subject is a book that invites these questions, and not everyone is as fortunate as I am to have the author to probe with these questions.
Thank you, and it was a very enjoyable conversation.
Cheers. Now, we are almost at the end of today's show. You are on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft. I want to say a huge thanks again to RWR McDonald and to Sarah Hopkins. They both joined me today to discuss their new books. If you missed anything, this is all going to be up on the podcast. Two new episodes, one for Rob McDonald, one for Sarah Hopkins. Wherever you subscribe to your podcast, if you don't subscribe to podcasts, pull out your phone, download an app. There's probably an app on there. Look for Final Draft Great Conversations and vote with your ears. It's our first birthday coming up soon, and I want to know your favourite podcast. Now, The Vulture's Nest is coming up next. I will be back next week with more books, writing and literary culture here on 2SER 107.3. My name's Andrew Popel. Until then, happy reading. Bye now.